my PhD at the Max Planck Institute for Physics and the LMU in Munich. And my PhD supervisor was Giyad Wali, and together with him, I developed this neutrino mass model during my PhD that I would like to present to you right now. So we also did other stuff, but I think this is perhaps the most interesting part, and it's something I'm also still working on, also partially in collaboration with people here at PIS. So I thought it might be good to give an introduction to this. And this is a low energy attempt, perhaps a possibility to solve the neutrino mass problem. So in the beginning, I would like to first remind you of something you all know very well. We have this huge gap between the neutrino masses that are observed and the masses of the charged fermions in the Stannard model. And this gap in between those masses is widely seen as unnatural. So people suggest or expect that the neutrino masses are not generated through the conventional Higgs mechanism as the masses of the other fermions in the Stannard model. And this is seen by many people as a puzzle. And how people usually try to address this problem is they go to high energy scales, for example, in the context of CISO mechanisms or large extra dimensions. And they assume that the neutrinos get a mass from the Higgs mechanism. So they get a Dirac mass at the electric scale. And somehow this mass then has to be suppressed so that we get this very small left-handed neutrino masses that we observe in nature. And for example, for Majorana neutrino mass models, most of them can be reduced to this Weinberg operator that I sketched down here. So there are daggers and all the stuff in there, but this is a sketch of it that, for example, if it's a seesaw mechanism, then the masses are small because of the Dirac mass generated at the electroweak scale. And then we have a very strong suppression coming from the Majorana mass at some ultraviolet energy scale, for example, the gut scale. And in models with large extra dimensions, we also have some kind of Weinberg operator structure in the sense that we have a suppression by a very small overlap of the wave function of the left-handed neutrino living on the four-dimensional bulk, where the Stannard model is confined to, and then the right-handed neutrinos are living in the higher dimensional brain. So we just have a very small wave function overlap. But what all these models have in common is that they require, in some sense, coupling to the Higgs condensate. And what we were now exploring, whether it's also possible to generate the masses beyond the Stannard model. So we just take the Stannard model as it is. We don't add any grand unified theory groups, any particles, or anything else. We just take the Stannard model as it is with massless fermions. And we see whether these effects could come from somewhere else. And what we found is that there is actually an inherent source of spontaneous symmetry breaking from gravity, if we couple the Stannard model minimally to gravity. And it's there if we assume the existence of a gravitational theta term, which is similar to the theta term of QCD. So I will discuss this assumption later, like what kind of arguments are there in favor or against it. And of course, these effects, they are supposed to happen at a specific energy scale. So intuitively, one might think this is the scale where gravity, perturbative gravity, becomes strong, like the Planck scale. But a priori, theoretically, if you can't, if you take the gravitational theta term as an assumption, the scale itself is a free parameter of the theory. So you can't theoretically predict it. And what we saw is that from phenomenological constraints, the scale has to be actually much lower. And what is interesting there is that we showed that in the presence of a theta term, you give rise to fermionic condensates and fermionic masses. And this happens at a new gravitational scale, which is phenomenologically constrained to be very small. And it turns out to be coincident with the scale of the neutrino mass splittings and the dark energy scale, just from phenomenological arguments. Yeah?
So when you say condensate, you just mean like nu bar nu, right?
Yes, so I will come to this. So this is just a summary, and now I wanted to go into the details.
So the most important assumption that you have right-handed neutrinos.
Not necessarily. This is something I will come to.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, there will be an order parameter of symmetry breaking. And I will discuss now the Dirac neutrino case. So I will discuss that we have left-handed and right-handed ones. Just because I would like to point out an analogy to QCD. So we know that a theta term exists in QCD and that they are very distinct effects of this theta term. And in order to make this comparison to the QCD case, I will assume for a second that neutrinos are Dirac particles, but they could also be Majorana. And this is something I will discuss later. All right, so yeah, we are calling QCD for help. And that's the way I have this, the reason why I have this picture there, because we have this question and we would like to answer it potentially without having the Higgs condensate involved. And in QCD, you probably all know it very well that we have a non-perturbative, topologically non-trivial vacuum, which gives rise to quark flavor symmetry breaking. So we have U3 left cross U3 right. We have a quark symmetry, which is approximate because we have small quark masses. And this is spontaneously broken by a quark condensate due to the topologically non-trivial vacuum in QCD. And in principle, this should give rise to 8 plus 1 mesons in the QCD sector. However, in nature, we only observe 8 light mesons. And this ninth meson, which is the eta prime meson, is much, much heavier than all its other pseudo-Goldstone companions. So this was historically a problem called U1 or eta prime problem. And the problem was that we had this U1 symmetry in the quark sector. We had the corresponding current and a corresponding pseudoscalar. So the question was, OK, if this is spontaneously broken, why don't we see a very light particle as the eta prime? So why does this eta prime have such a large mass, such much larger than the mass of other pseudo-Goldstone mesons? And the resolution of this puzzle was that we actually get a mass contribution. So we have the divergence of this symmetry. Can you see this? Yeah, OK, here. So the symmetry is actually not a real symmetry of the system, but it's spoiled by this QCD anomaly, Adler-Beljakov anomaly. So we get a very large mass contribution for the eta prime coming from this g tilde term. And on the level of the Lagrangian, this gives rise to a physical theta term in the presence of this non-trivial topological QCD vacuum. So we have a theta angle. Then we have the gluon field strength. And g tilde is the Hodge dual of the gluon field strength. So we have this physical theta term. And we know it should, in principle, be observable just because we know that there are non-perturbative effects in QCD. So GG tilde is a total derivative. One might think we can just omit it from the Lagrangian, but we know that there are non-perturbative effects that make the term physical, even though it's a total derivative. So we get boundary terms. So we have a large mass contribution for the eta prime meson coming from QCD, which is this GG tilde term. And then we have an additional contribution coming from the small explicit symmetry breaking because we have very small quark masses in the standard model. So this U1 symmetry was from the very beginning only an approximate symmetry. OK, then one result, which is very important, obtained in the 80s, is that the fact that one has a physical theta term, so physical means that this theta parameter should be observable. So it's not just a mathematical artifact, that if we have a physical theta term in pure QCD, then this corresponds to having a non-vanishing topological vacuum susceptibility, which is precisely this correlator. So you have GG tilde, and the limit of zero momentum should be a constant in pure glue, so without any quarks. And if we then add quarks to the theory with very small masses, then we can express this topological susceptibility in terms of the masses and a bilinear quark condensate. And here we see that this would vanish in the limit of zero quark masses, which would give a resolution of the strong CP problem, which has been discussed very widely. OK, so this is a QCD story. I just remind you of it. I don't know if you're probably, I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, but I think it's good to see what we know. And now the question is how general these effects are. So what are these effects dependent on? Are they dependent on the perturbative regime of QCD or the non-perturbative? Or are they dependent on confinement or not? So this is something that was examined for many decades. But in particular, there were papers like more than 10 years ago by Dvali and Jakif and P and other people who found out that you only need a physical theta term, and you immediately, in the presence of a chiral anomaly, like the anomaly like here, there you can see it with a pointer, you can immediately generate a mass gap in the system. So this mass gap is precisely this eta prime mass that we observe in QCD. And what they then argued is that this, because it only depends on the presence of the theta term, so also this relation between the susceptibility and the condensate is independent of the characteristics like confinement in QCD, that this is transferable to other theories. So we know that this happens, for example, in the Schwinger model, like 1+1 dimensional QED. And they argued that if we have a physical theta term in gravity, then you can actually see that you will also get a mass gap in the theory. And this is something I would like to discuss now. But so
is there any known example where that happens perturbatively?
No, it has to be non-perturbative. Yeah. So you need a physical theta term, and this can only happen in the perturbative regime.
So,
and this,
suppose I gave you the physical theta term, and then you want to extract some implications for things. Are there any examples where that extraction is perturbative?
Can you ask it again? So this topological susceptibility is inherently non-perturbative. So at the perturbative level, this is going to vanish.
Out there, the one level of, I think what you're saying is that at the high energies, I need something non-perturbative to generate that term in the first place in the effect of low energy theory. But then a second question is, in the low energy theory, once I've got that term, do I need non-perturbative physics at low energies? I'm interested in that second question, because that's, you know, most of the strong interactions are there in the low energies. So in all these examples, and I'm asking this because I want to have some intuition about gravity, right? So let's say, so in all these examples, my understanding is that you really needed to have some non-perturbative physics to get physics out of the theta term. Right?
That gets strong at the scale, yeah. So this is an important thing, that this GD tilde term gets strong at one specific scale in the system. And these non-perturbative effects have to get strong at this scale, yeah.
But when you say
so
that, the
you have a non-perturbative interaction that gives rise to the condensate.
So maybe I can refine the question. Yeah. So in QCD, there's the theta parameter and there's the coupling constant. And I think, and now you're talking about getting, when you say that the GD dual is getting strong, you mean the theta parameter is getting large or something. Is that what you mean? Strong interactions, I'm thinking the coupling constant for QCD is large, right?
So non-perturbative strong interactions. So that's the main thing. So you have in a priori, in QCD, we have a specific situation because we know that the numbers of colors, the number of colors is 3. So we know that, for example, if you go to the large N limit, you have many colors in QCD, you can effectively turn off non-perturbative effects. So these instanton effects and these 1/n effects found by Witten and Veneziano, they scale as exponent minus n or 1/n.
I think you're agreeing with me, but I'm not sure.
Hmm?
I think you're agreeing with me, but I'm not really sure. So you're saying that it's important in the QCD case that the strong coupling G was strong to get a non-trivial contribution of the theta parameter to something physical.
So what I'm saying is that the computation of this topological susceptibility is independent of the coupling of the G, of the perturbative coupling.
I can answer maybe, Cliff. Well, you could go in principle to say higher temperatures where there would be still a perturbative control over things, because G is not, but then the instanton action relative to the rest would be less. So there would be still non-perturbative effects, but they would be suppressed by.
There's a separate issue as how big the effects are, but it's not analytic in G, right?
It's going to be non-analytic in G because the instanton action is non-analytic in G.
So in QCD, we know that there are specific effects like instantons that scale like 1/g². And so we know in QCD, we know the origin of the theta term, and therefore we know where these effects become strong.
Right.
But
yeah, I'm happy now.
So what they were pointing out, okay, so let me come to the gravitational case, because otherwise it takes very long. So that's the reason why I just have 11 slides. So I know there will be a lot of discussions. Yeah, so what they showed, if we have this one single assumption that we also have a theta term in a different theory, for example, in gravity. And we know that the theta term itself has been computed like in the 80s. So this is it's well known that the term exists, but it's not known whether it's physical or not, because it's also total derivative. It may be just be integrated away. But there are a lot of non-perturbative solutions found, like gravitational instantons, wormholes, micro-black holes. So these are semi-classical solutions, similar to the instanton case that we just discussed. And there are also, there may be pure quantum contributions, just as we know in QCD, there are also pure quantum contributions, which are not semi-classical, but that we can't compute unless we have a complete theory of quantum gravity. So it is known that the term exists, but it's not known whether it's physical or not. So the philosophy that we wanted to take here is that we take it as a starting assumption that this term exists. We don't know at which scale it becomes strong, because in QCD we know that...
What does it mean for it to become strong when you say...
The GG tilde, or like in this case, so theta is an angular parameter, R is the Riemann tensor, and R tilde is the Hodge dual of the Riemann tensor.
Yeah.
And strong in this scenario means that you have non-perturbative effects that become strong.
Non-perturbative as a function of theta? Non-perturbative in what?
You have, so non-perturbative in the sense that you can't resolve them at any order of perturbation theory, like in QCD, the 1 over n effects. You have to resum over all the diagrams there.
Right, so in that case, that was a non-perturbative in G, the Kolmogorov
yeah.
constant. So in this case, non-perturbative in what? Is it going to be something to do with Newton's constant?
Yeah, I mean, the point here is that because in QCD, we don't know precisely that. So the scales are very close to each other, but we only know that these non-perturbative effects become strong there because we know if we write down, for example, instanton effects like 1 over G squared.
I'm not asking any deep, I just want to first what it means to be non-perturbative. So
mm-hmm. So it is not required that the perturbative coupling itself becomes strong at the scale itself.
Can I try it? Mm-hmm. You tell me if I don't want to put words in your mouth that's coming.
Yeah.
But she's going to have a scale associated with g tilde squared in the Lagrangian. That physical scale is non-perturbative in the sense that it has nothing to do with the weak coupling constant of beta.
And it's going to be exponentially or power law suppressed with respect to the cutoff.
So maybe just wait, but it's not what you're thinking. It's not.
Well,
it's not weak in. It's not weak in any.
Non-perturbative to me is there's a series in something. I just want to know what the something is.
Yeah, I think that's not the line. No, maybe they don't call it non-perturbative. It's just.
Let's see where you go.
Yeah. Just why don't you wait? Yeah. Because I've read the paper.
Isn't the point that perturbative means there's a series in something, but non-perturbative doesn't necessarily mean that you can still express it in a coupling or a series. That also happens in QCD, right? If you go to very small energies, QCD becomes so non-perturbative that you can't even define a gauge coupling, a single gauge coupling.
Yeah, but when I'm making the distinction between perturbative and non-perturbative, I was in a regime where perturbative made sense, and so I knew what I was perturbing in.
And then there's some other.
So before we leave it, what was the regime where?
Just talking about this specific GG dual correlator, right? You can calculate it in any order of perturbation theory, right?
And it's zero.
In strong coupling constant, right?
Right.
And it remains identically zero.
Exactly.
Yeah, and this is precisely why it's non-perturbative.
And then once you postulate that it's non-zero, that's the measure of your non-perturbative effect.
And it has to be non-perturbative, just that it doesn't appear.
So when you say zero, I'm completely happy that it's in the action, so that we're saying that let's just agree that theta g is zero, is not zero. But when you say it's non-zero, you mean the expectation value of theta r dual is non-zero, and that's a scale?
No.
So it's
the expectation value of g dual squared.
Yes. Yeah. So this is the topological vacuum susceptibility that is non-zero. It's not theta. Theta is just an angular parameter. It's not. It's just like in QCD, without any axion, without any massless quarks, you just have a constant.
I just deleted the word non-perturbative from everything you said. Right? Am I going to miss anything?
Okay, no, you won't. I mean, non-perturbative. Yeah.
There's going to be a non-zero expectation, right?
Yeah, it's so the main point is that you have a topological vacuum susceptibility that is non-vanishing, and because we know that from in any order, as you said, in perturbative expansion, it's zero. You need some. Some physics that makes it non-zero has to be, in some sense, non-perturbative. But
right.
You can delete this.
What's frustrating for me is that I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
And so that means there's some physics that's non-perturbative, but I want to know in my list of physics that I know, is it one of the ones I know, or is it something new? Is it gravity, or is it QCD, or what's who are we talking about that got non-perturbative to make this thing non-zero? Should we be thinking of some new physics, or is this old physics that got non-perturbative?
So, I mean, we don't know any solutions at the moment that could give rise to a non-trivial topological vacuum susceptibility in gravity. So it's definitely something new.
The minimum assumption I need to follow your talk is that there's some physics that makes the RR dual zero momentum correlation function not zero.
This is the minimal assumption. And it's some scale. And it's the only assumption that enters here to make connections to similar things happening.
At some scale, what that means is not p still goes to zero, but the value of that correlation function has dimensions, and that's the scale you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like in QCD. Mm-hmm.
And just to check,
When
you write down RR dual, you mean two Riemanns, the first two indices of each of the two Riemanns been factored with an epsilon, and the remaining indices factored with each other, or something else?
Yeah, so it's like epsilon. Can you read this?
No.
Damn. Yeah. Or I can just talk. So it's like epsilon.
No, that we can read.
Yeah, that you can read? Okay.
Yeah, that's all right.
So yes, some raw sigma. So you have some non-trivial contraction of the Riemann tensors.
I'm just trying to check that it's not one of the parents that for by the reasons I haven't been over problematic, so I just wanted to
okay.
Make sure
no, it's there.
That's the sequence. Okay. Good.
Yeah. So this is I will yeah. yeah. So yeah, so this theta term contribution just comes from the computations from Lisa and Hisham in the 1980s. Yeah. Okay, so if you have this non-zero topological vacuum susceptibility, then it was shown that you can apply some of these tools we know from the QCD sector. So this was shown by Dvali and Jakif and P in 2006 in a PRL publication, and by Dvali and some of his PhD students also very recently, that in this case, if you have a non-zero topological vacuum susceptibility, you immediately, in the presence of an axial anomaly, so if you add massless fermions to the theory, you generate a mass gap in the fermionic sector of the theory. And as they pointed out, this is very generic in the sense that you only need this, it's called Chern-Pontryagin density, so the cosmologists don't need to remember that. But this is the only quantity that we need, non-vanishing, in order to have this mass gap in any fermionic sector if we couple the fermions to the gauge theory that contains the theta term. And it was worked out, if we take gravity and we consider the lightest fermions of the standard model, which are the neutrinos, and we couple it, we couple the neutrinos to gravity, we immediately have an axial anomaly if we consider Dirac neutrinos, for example. And this immediately gives rise to a new massive degree of freedom in the neutrino sector, which is a pseudo-scalar degree of freedom, and it's a neutrino bilinear. And
there is no such is bilinear standard model unless you do the conjugate of the neutrino.
If you have the right-handed ones, yeah.
Yeah,
but,
you need the right-handed.
So no, you don't need it. So here I'm discussing the Dirac one, the Dirac case where you have the right-handed, but it works. So you also have an anomaly in the Majorana case. So the crucial ingredient is that you need a symmetry which is anomalous with respect to gravity in the fermionic sector. And then the argument goes.
I can write a current with neutrinos that has axial current only with left-handed, right? But then if I take the derivative of it, you're saying that there would be some terms that would contain the bilinear that will break the lepton number?
So you would have...
there is an anomaly for bial fermions. The question is, what is the bilinear?
Yeah, so I mean, if you look at the condensate structure, for example, like for the Dirac case, we're considering condensates like that. For the Majorana case, you would... have a condensate only for the left-handed ones. So
there would be then two signs of these condensates. There would be one with plus and one with minus.
And you would get lepton number for
the lepton number.
Yes,
right?
they will carry lepton number. Yeah.
So,
yeah, because this is then, I mean, that's the whole point of the.
But this condensate cannot appear, say, in the anomaly of axial current.
So I'm talking about the axial current
the axial current does not have any lepton number associated.
Yeah, but this is so the axial current is important in the Dirac case. But it's about the current that is anomalous with respect to gravity, given the fermion content. And I'm considering here the Dirac fermion content. There it's the axial anomaly. If we go to the Majorana content, it's a lepton number that is. So here it's an axial lepton number, and in the Dirac case, if we only have left-handed ones, it's the lepton number, like not the axial one. Yeah.
I try. So something that I guess the thing that's bothering me is that normally I just want to know what the rules are at some level. And normally, if it's a quantum field theory, I can calculate all these correlation functions if you allow me to do it perturbatively, let's say. So I'm imagining that if you just gave me the rules are, it's a standard model, and I add this operator, and then I just see what I get. Then and I go to high energies where QCD is not strong. So then if I just calculate that susceptibility, it seems like I should be able to calculate what it is, and it's probably going to be zero perturbatively and all these things. So this assumption that I have to buy that this thing is not zero sounds like it's not just I add that thing to the standard model and I run with that. I have to have some reason why there's a state, the vacuum state is more complicated than I thought it was in the standard model, in addition to this thing, right? So that means there's another sector, the scale which this is going to point to is coming from this other sector that made the ground state more complicated. So is that fair?
So you're back in QCD, not gravity.
Yeah, so are you talking about QCD?
I could do it either of them. But the thing is that if the sales is that the gravity is behaving like QCD, I know what that means. And so that means I take the theory, I take the vacuum, and I just calculate all these things, because if you told me what the theory is, I can do it at high energies where things are perturbative, and I just learn what everything is, and then I can tell you whether things are perturbative or not in the coupling constants, because that's what we do in QCD. So I'm imagining if I now do that for gravity, and if the rules are there's no other dynamics but the standard model dynamics, then it sounds like I'm not going to get anything. So
Cliff is asking basically, who is the analog of instant ones?
Yeah,
right?
So what are the fields that are seeing this thing and giving me the new physics?
Yeah, I mean, there have been many, many solutions discussed, like, for example, instantons and everything. But the point is that they've been computed, for example, at the Planck scale. So you have a very strong suppression of those. Yeah, and then if one then therefore follows from that the scale of this correlator should be somehow the Planck scale, because this is where gravity perturbatively becomes strong, then what we show, okay, so I haven't gone to this yet, because, oh, Jesus, already half an hour going on. So what you can show is that in the presence of a topological susceptibility, you immediately generate chiral symmetry breaking dynamically in the fermion sector. So you get some kind of condensates in the presence of axial and lepton anomalies. No, and the point is that if you say that a priori you expect this to be at the Planck scale, this is something you can rule out just phenomenologically. So this is the main point we want to make, is that if you just have the assumption that a topological vacuum susceptibility is non-zero, you can see phenomenologically whether this is allowed or not, because you can work out the consequences for.
So the reason, my problem with that is that it's like, and this is, I'm sure that's not what you mean, but to me, the only way I can parse what you said is that I have a quantum field theory I know what to calculate with, but I'm supposed to take something I normally calculate and just say, I don't calculate that, just someone tells me it's equal to something. And so that.
But that happens in QCD too.
Yeah, in QCD you can't.
Yes, it does. That's zero in any order. But on the lattice, there's evidence that you do
right,
get
it. Right, but that's a calculation.
It's a calculation.
Everything we know is based on
calculation. Okay, so do lattice gravity, and maybe you get the answer.
But. Well, so that's the thing. So that means that the reason that it's a relevant question is that means that if I were to imagine, if it is gravity, so that might be one of the, maybe the answer is it's gravity. I don't know that's where you're going. But if it's gravity, then I would expect that whatever the effects are I'm going to find, it's going to go like exponentially small in M Planck over some scale, and then we can talk about how small that is or how big that is. But at least I know what I'm. At least I have some way to think about how big it is. And whereas so far the.
But this is so. I mean, if you look at QCD, you see that these effects. If you consider, for example, instanton effects, it's 1/n. If you have pure quantum effects, it's just 1/n. So you know that this is exponential suppression with respect to the Planck scale. N is the number of colors in QCD. So
we're talking about QCD again.
Yeah, if we talk about QCD. So if we talk about the gravity case,
yeah,
and
case,
yeah.
What should I be thinking about?
So the point, that's the reason why we're saying there are many different solutions discussed that might contribute to the theta term. We don't know which ones, because we need a full theory of quantum gravity to know which ones could be contributing. So
Maybe
we take this.
Example I can think about, just because I don't know any. So what would be an example? It's the simplest one to think
about.
Yeah,
so people have discussed, for example, virtual Michael Beckles or instantons, like gravitational ones. And then you know you get some exponential suppression factor, which is inherent to all non-perturbative solutions. But the point is that we wanted to make is that from a theoretical point of view, it's just an open question. And we know that anomalies are scale insensitive. So if you have an anomaly in the UV, you also have an anomaly in the IR. And if you have this physical theta term at some scale, you should have it at all scales, and you should
What would be the N in that example of black holes? How do I think about how big these things are supposed to be?
Yeah, so for micro black holes, people have discussed this as like the black hole mass over the Planck mass squared. People have discussed many kinds of solutions. So
that or the other way around? Is it black?
So it's.
Is it perturbative at 1/m Planck, or is it not perturbative?
I mean, it is definitely larger than one because you have a strong suppression. So it's.
So it's implying over M.
Sorry, did I? Yeah. Sorry, I said it. Oh, sorry, I said it the other way around. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I ask another naive question?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have a Hamiltonian sign also. And again, similar side to proof. So in GG tilde is a total derivative of a current, which is so a surface term, and I'm not allowed to think I can throw out this term because. G, you can have a physical configuration where the gluon fields are not zero at infinity.
Mm.
They are a gauge transformation of zero. A gauge transformation is an SU3 transformation. Now, how should I think about all of this in gravity? Let's suppose I just did a 101 course on GR. I know nothing about quantum gravity.
Mm.
You tell me this is a total derivative of something which will contain G mu nu and its derivatives. And you're saying to me that I shouldn't throw out this term. Why? Are you going to show more about this R tilde term maybe later? I'm not understanding why a total derivative should not disappear unless you have some instanton effects or something.
Yes, but this is precisely the point. So it could be that it just disappears. You could also have non-perturbative effects that make it non-vanishing. But the point is that here you can, like from a phenomenological point of view, rule out these kinds of non-perturbative effects on all kinds of energy scales. And on the gravitational sector, okay, you were talking about the gauge transformations, you would have you have diffeomorphism invariance, so you know, like the analog of the SU3 gauge transformations, and you can express this GG tilde term as I said, an exterior derivative of some like Chern Simons 3 form, and in the gravitational case, you can you have an analogous Chern Simons 3 form for the gravitational case that you can express in terms of the Christoffel symbols instead of the
yeah.
So here C is something like if you forget about the like numerical factors so with wedge and so on and so forth, and in the gravitational sector you have it with the Christoffel.
The Christoffel, okay.
Yeah. So the point is that these both of these Chern-Simons terms exist both in QCD and in gravity. We just know in the QCD case that they have physical significance because we have, for example, instanton solutions, and that's the only claim. So if you have a topological susceptibility, for example, in QCD, GD tilde, where the momentum goes to zero is unequal to zero, so it's a constant, then this corresponds to the field C having a massless pole, because you can just take twice the derivative. And then you see that as soon as you introduce massless quarks, this has to vanish, which is only possible if you get some, if the pole is vanishing there. So this is what's happening in QCD, where you can effectively express this as a kind of Higgs effect, if you want to see it like that. So you have some kind of gauge field which has no propagating degrees of freedom. So there's no issue with that, which
is
becomes
that
massive.
This pole is the pole that's asking for this. It comes to you.
Yeah, but the point is that in the anomaly, you have also a massless pole, and they're canceling, and then you get the massless pole, massive pole in the end. So this is how it works in QCD. Yeah. Mm. So you get a massive pole there. And you can show, which was done in those papers, that this formulation, so as soon as you have a topological vacuum susceptibility, which is non-zero, that this corresponds to getting a massive pole in this three form here, requires by a gauge invariance that you get a massive new degree of freedom in the theory, which has to be a pseudoscalar, and especially pseudoscalar corresponding to exactly the current that is anomalous in the theory. So this is the theoretical argument behind it. So the only thing that goes into it is the existence of a non-vanishing constant topological vacuum system.
NCG, how would it look like in Minkowski or De Sitter? Would it be automatically zero or no?
Yeah, so this is a question of your solutions. I mean, of your non-perturbative solutions. So
there exist Euclidean solutions, I think, with this not zero.
Yeah, yeah. So you have them like gravitational and synthetic solutions and all that stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, so there are many solutions discussed. Some of them only exist if you have a positive cosmological constant. Some of them, are independent of that. So it depends which kind of solutions you're discussing.
I want to point out that Veneziano's paper is called
Without instantons. Yeah, you don't need
so
the instantons at all.
Is that
so
as long as this is non-zero, I don't know where it comes from. You can be completely agnostic about which solutions to be using, whether a semi-classical approximation is valid or not. As long as you just put that term in, you get the right current output.
And that's the only thing.
The right mass of the
air. And that's the only thing you need. So you only start with a constant.
Yeah, I'm happy. But the thing about QCD is that
You don't calculate it. It's put in by hand.
But the thing is that, that is, putting things in by hand is kind of hard for me to understand. But in QCD, I'd say there's two ways to think about this. And I think I'm getting a better sense as to what you mean in the gravity case. But in the QCD case, it could have been something exponentially small with a coupling constant, or you could just say, what's the scale? And it would be the QCD scale. And they're kind of related because I'm asking, when did the coupling constant become strong? And that gave me the scale. So if we're doing the gravity case, when you talked about the black holes, the e to the minus m Planck squared over m, that kind of sounds like e to the minus one over coupling constant.
Mm.
Then if I thought of it in terms of the scale language, you don't want me to think of the Planck scale as being that scale, right? You want me to think of some other scale.
Yeah, and that's the reason why we're saying, okay, we know in QCD, for example, instantons, we can forget about them. So that's the reason why, because if the perturbative coupling in the gravitational case is very weak at the scales that we'll discuss later. Yeah. So that's the reason why we're saying, okay, I mean, in principle, a priori, this is just a free parameter of the theory. And we're not going into the depth of the
thing that I'm trying to understand because what I'm gathering is that the way I'm supposed to think about this is that it's going to be gravitational physics that will give me the contribution. The physics we're talking about is gravitational physics, right? And so it's the integral over the metric that is the thing that's going to control my neutrino mass at the end of the day. But we're at really low energies that we're going to do this kind of thing. And so that what makes me nervous is that you're going to be, I think you're saying that I'm going to have to say that the rules have changed for gravity somehow at low energies in a not hard to quantify way. And then I kind of don't know, well, what do I trust and what do I not trust about gravity at low energies? That's kind of, whereas I would have.
Whether this modifies like the graviton propagator and stuff like that, or.
Yeah, but a very, very perturbative regime, right? We're going to be in a regime where we really, really are. It's like being a QCD at really high energies, and we're.
I mean, you could. I mean, there are ways of lowering the quantum gravity scale to TeV or something. So, I mean, of course, there's a huge gap in between. But I mean, you could be close to the standard model with the strong coupling regime. And I know, of course, there's a gap you can overcome.
I'm happy to use that as my way to guide my thinking. So I should think of maybe a weak scale, extra dimensions. The weak scale is the gravity scale. But in the end of the day, the scale that sets this thing will be that scale, it sounds like. Is that...
Yep.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind and I'll shut up for a while.
Okay. we will come to that later to see like on which scales this is just excluded.
Okay.
And that's coming directly from those considerations. Yeah. Okay.
It's completely wrong. About
So, all right. So in these previous papers, I already, so the way how you actually show that in the presence of a non-zero topological vacuum susceptibility, you get a new massive degree of freedom. So this is a very short summary of that. What you effectively do is you write down a low energy effective theory of this field C. and see what happens if you couple fermions to the theory. So you have an anomaly, which gives you a contact interaction between this field C and the fermionic current, which is anomalous. And you can see then, by just solving the equations of motions, that that you get, for example, in the presence of a massless neutrino, or say three different massless neutrinos, if you have a U1 symmetry and a corresponding U1 current, you will get a massive new pseudoscalar degree of freedom. And that gets a huge mass from exactly these effects that make the topological vacuum susceptibility non-zero. So you have a mass contribution coming from this RL tilde. And if you assume neutrinos to be massive, then getting hard masses from somewhere else, you would also have an explicit symmetry breaking contribution.
This is all in the presence of right-handed neutrinos.
Yes, now this is still in the presence of right-handed neutrinos. And what you can then show in this low energy effective formulation of this three-form field C is that you can express this correlator of DC-DC in terms of an order parameter that spontaneously breaks exactly this U1 asymmetry in order to give rise to the massive degree of freedom that makes this three-form massive. So
is
this
is an equation down that shows that, or is that the?
Yes, I have them in the. Wait, I think. Oh, so I have to. Okay, so this will take some time. Yeah, it's okay. I have it in. Yeah, so okay, this is what I wrote down here on the blackboard, and then okay, they called it a three-form Higgs effect in those papers. So you just write down an effective theory of this field. You can, of course, have higher orders, but they don't matter in this case, like also the...
And when you say, because you're dividing by box, you don't mean here like a Wilsonian effect, you mean like a 1PI action for...
This is just coming from the contact interaction from the gravitational anomaly. So you have a triangle diagram, and this immediately gives you a contact interaction between the...
But if I were to
the neutrino current.
A story, I could parse what you're saying if I was doing it in terms of some 1PI action where I'm following the path of some field, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can I think of that as this is what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean this is independent on whether this EG is now whether the E or the C are coming from the gravitational or the QCD sector. That's irrelevant. I mean, in both cases, you have a similar anomaly structure, and you have a similar contact interaction that is generated. And then if you solve the equations of motions for your three-form field, you see that this is giving rise to a mass gap in your field. So you don't have any massless modes in your field. And
the reason I'm not shutting up is that I'd like to actually, so how do I think about L? So am I supposed to think of L as I've integrated out all the high energy?
But which L?
Your Lagrangian.
The Lagrange. Ah, yeah. Okay. So this is just okay. You just take a look at the topological sector of your gauge theory. You say that you have a non-zero topological vacuum susceptibility, which is just this susceptibility, and you can express this in terms of a three-form field. And this is a three-form Lagrangian that you have here. So you can consider it.
You're telling me how to approximate something, and I just want to kind of know what, in principle, was I trying to calculate before I did the approximation. So what I'm imagining, when you say effective Lagrange, I'm imagining that you integrated out some high energy degrees of freedom. We're getting down to low energies where we're going to look at the neutrino mass, and then there's one of two things that you might mean. One is that I'm looking at the Wilsonian action at that point, and I'm calculating. So I haven't integrated out the light fields yet, and so I'm going to take this Lagrangian, and I'm supposed to treat it like I would treat a Wilsonian action. The other thing you might have meant is that this is 1PI generator where I've integrated with everything, and I'm just tracking this. I'm supposed to think of these fields as being VEVs of things. So I just solve their equations of motion. I don't integrate over them. Which should I think of?
No, I mean, you haven't integrated out the massless from
here not,
yet. No, you haven't integrated them out. So this is, we considered here like only massless ones, for example, the neutrinos.
So then, if that's the case, then the party line would have been you never get non-local things like 1/box because you get those by integrating out the massless degrees of freedom. So you can get things that look funny when you try to put in non-local things in an effective Lagrangian, but if you're starting from regular physics, normally the uncertainty principle keeps you from getting those things. So if I'm supposed to integrate this thing with light fields seeing that action, there's lots of things I'd start worrying about, like the ghosts and all kinds of things, if you're allowing me to put in terms like that.
But this contact interaction is exactly what's arising in QCD from the triangle. I know
the contact, he's worried about the one of the bots which comes from the triangle, which is integrating out masses from
right. So the QCD case, it would have been a 1 PI thing.
Same PI, I think.
Yeah, but okay. So I thought you wanted to integrate out the.
I just want to know if you give me this Lagrangian and I want to kind of reproduce later on today what you did. Are the rules that I just classically solve the fields and I plug them in, or am I supposed to do a path interval weighted by this thing? It sounds like the I should think of this as being like one PI action where I'm just varying fields. I'm going to learn what the values are by varying the fields, but I'm not going to do an interval.
Yeah, you're in the low energy theory. So in the high energy theory, you have, let's say in the QCD case, you have the massless fields. You can like rotate your theta angle away. Then you can go into the low energy regime in which you have the condensation.
Yeah.
And this is then from the triangle anomaly. This is the regime that we're considering now. So this is below the scale of condensation. So I guess this is what you mean with then integrating out the high energy degrees of freedom. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Okay. So I don't know. I mean, it's now already 50 minutes, and I don't know like in which direction I should go. So I mean,
go back to your talk.
I can go. Yeah. I mean, okay. So yeah, it takes a long time to go back. Yeah. I mean, I can also skip some of the
don't right, worry about it. Just can
the final stuff. Yeah. Anyway, okay, so if you have a non-zero topological susceptibility, you can, with this low energy effective Lagrangian, can show that you get a massive neutrino bilinear pseudoscalar. In the Dirac case here that I'm discussing now, and I will come to the Marana case later. And yes, so you know that this susceptibility and this effects that give rise to the susceptibility are introducing a new scale in the system. And a priori, you don't know what the scale exactly is. So let me just go through this. Yeah, OK. So you can forget about the non-perturbative if you're asking, like, yeah. No, so the most. Yeah. I mean, the ingredient that we have is that we take this vacuum susceptibility to be non-zero in the limit of momentum going to zero, and then we get a new scale in the system. And we don't know what the scale of the system is. Apart from the fact that we would expect it to be exponentially suppressed, but because we don't specify the origin of this correlator, then we can't compute the scale from first principles. So we take it as a free parameter, and we see whether this is allowed on any scale, at any scales of the standard model. And if you couple this now pure gravity case to the fermions of the standard model, then what I said before is that you have this through the gravitational anomaly, you get some spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking in the neutrino sector, which means that you necessarily get a condensate, because you can't give rise to this new massive degree of freedom unless you have a spontaneous symmetry breaking of exactly this this U1 current that I considered before.
Yeah. Nice question. Why neutrinos are, this would be true for any.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this would be in principle true for any fermions. We are just considering neutrinos now because they are the lightest fermions in the standard model. So they're analogous to the quarks of QCD, but this is going to affect other fermions as well.
Returning to Cliff's objections, it's still not going to be like operational in the sense that it's not going to lead us to being able to calculate any graph in your theory, right? One nice thing would have been if you assume the value of this correlator, and then, okay, at low energy, you can calculate every effect. Mm. It's still not going to be the case.
No. So the point is that, no, I mean, what you can...
What are the rules then?
No, but I mean, what you can relate is if you have the non-zero topological vacuum susceptibility, what you can compute is the connection to the spontaneous symmetry breaking in the Fermion sector.
Left-handed neutrinos the antiparticle width, which is anti-neutrino, getting into right-handed degrees of freedom. This is scattering, right? Because we know that in the standard model in cosmology, it's very important that the right-handed neutrinos are not populated, right?
So yeah.
I'd like to be able to calculate that process.
So, okay, wait a moment. So we have, what we have in QCD, we have the Toft vertex. So we know what kind of vertex gives rise, for example. This gives a mass contribution for the quarks as well. And the point is that in our case, if we have these effects, the Toft vertex equivalent is, the point is that it is going to soften at high energy scales. But
can you predict how it's going to soften, or like what the rules are for computation?
No, I mean, it's a power law suppression, but you don't know by which power. So this is something you have to phenomenologically constrain.
So there is more input than just non-zero, right?
Not more assumptions, but there are more unknowns. That's definitely the case. So you don't, for example, know the effective potential that you will generate for the order parameters.
I understand if there is an infinite amount of unknowns, or because like I said, it would be nice if you assume some number and then after that everything follows,
that's
right?
That's what happens in QCD.
That's right. That's everything follows. But here, if we would have to, you know, each time pick different rules, that would be bad, right?
I mean, we have this one single assumption that it's not vanishing. And then we have several unknowns because we don't know at which scales it vanishes and we don't know the softening of the vertex itself.
Have all these assumptions specified, right? I mean, the assumptions, but unknowns, right? Because this prevents it from being a theory, right?
I mean, you have, independently of the amount of how much it softens and everything, you can have some, I mean, you have, even though you have like three parameters of the theory, you can still have some predictions that are independent of those, that are strong enough to make the theory be falsified, for example. So in that sense, I mean, you're right. So we have this one assumption, then we know that the unknowns are, we don't know at which scale this becomes important, but this is something you can phenomenologically constrain very strongly. Then the softening is something we can also constrain very strongly. And then you see that you get some predictions that are like even independent of those parameters holding true. For example, we will see later that because we have those new Goldstone bosons in the neutrino sector, the neutrinos will annihilate away in the late universe. So you don't have any massive hot dark matter component in the late universe. And this is something you can experimentally probe even without precisely defining the or knowing or having some theoretical input about the softening at the scale itself. Yeah. So of course you can make a list of things that you don't know. Sure. Yeah.
What are the unknown unknowns? You'll show us some examples, right?
What?
We're just, you know, we don't know how to calculate anything given what you told us so far.
But you're going to show us some examples where you think you can predict something without these unknowns being a problem, it sounds like.
Go
ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you have a spontaneous symmetry breaking in the neutrino sector, you will get Goldstones, and you know that the couplings of, the Goldstone-neutrino couplings are determined by the masses of the neutrinos and by the symmetry breaking scale, for example. So you know precisely what kind of couplings you have between these Goldstones and the neutrinos.
But to do that, for example, I would imagine you need to know a complete set of what all the order parameters are. And I gather the neutrinos have VEBs, but it sounds like also other fermions have VEBs too. Is that right? So every fermion Brillouinier that I could think of has got a VEB?
Yeah, but the point is that, for example, in QCD, we also know that the very heavy quarks will get a VEB, but it's very strongly suppressed. So we know that the heavy fermions for, let's say, fermion masses much larger than the symmetry breaking scale, you will get, I don't know if you can see this, but I hope so, you will get condensates that are suppressed like the scale to the power of 4 divided by the fermion mass. So this is something, at least the decoupling of heavy fermion flavors is going like this in QCD. And we would expect that any kind of heavy fermion mass contribution for the condensate is very strongly suppressed by the inverse of the mass that we consider.
Nice thing about QCD, you can integrate it out, right? You will get GMU squared operator, you will know its VEB phenomenologically, you can do a lot better than
with new marks, right? So you can have it developed, right? And here.
I mean, here in this case, we know experimental constraints on, for example, the electron mass, and we know that this is going to give us a constraint on the scale where this is going to happen. If we take this,
how is it going to affect, for example, the binding energy? That we know as we know to humongous precision, right?
Yeah, I mean, you have, like, for example, from alpha measurements, you know that the mass is known to a precision of like 10 to the minus 8 of the electron mass. And you know that this is going to give, if you just make this very simple estimate, then you get a constraint on the scale of something like 0.33 electron volts. But the point is, if you, as you said, I mean, if you write down just the generic form of the effective potential, then if you minimize this effective potential, then the minimum itself is, it's because it's a dynamical process, you can't predict precisely what kind of masses will come out in the end, on what kind of condensates.
There's some pattern of breaking the open line where G breaks to H. They gave you 14. What was the assumption of what G and H were?
Yeah, so the point is that what one can show is from the anomaly arguments that you should necessarily get one of those, and you should necessarily break the C1 symmetry. But if we look at neutrinos, and that's the reason why I said up to 14 Goldstones, because now if you say that you have a spontaneous symmetry breaking effect in the neutrino sector and you want to generate all the masses from it, you have hierarchical masses, what we just know from observation. So this is a phenomenological input. So you know that you have to break this U3 symmetry in the neutrino sector further than in the quark sector, for example. There you break it down to U3 vectorial symmetry, and but this is going to give equal mass contributions for the quarks. And a priori, one can always have off-diagonal contributions in the flavor basis as well. But in this case, one would get more Goldstones. And that's the case if one wants to explain the masses with it. So, I mean, model independently.
Just to make sure I'm tracking what you're saying. So they're coming from the breaking of the U3 that rotates the three proton doublets together.
Yeah.
So if I were to try and organize how to think about that, you're saying that it's not clear what the expectation values are to the not being able to count as a function of not knowing what all the order parameters are. So when it comes down to this, the counting of these Goldstone bosons, do you know that there's more than one? I mean, I guess you must know that there's at least.
Yeah. So the point is, so you have to. In order to generate hierarchical neutrino masses, you have to break the symmetry, the original left-right symmetry, for example, in the Dirac case, you have to break it down to U3-1, which are like individual conservation of the neutrino individual lepton numbers, if we consider Dirac, for example. So if you have a mass matrix, which is something like M1, M2, M3, then this is, then...
Here you have right-handed neutrinos for that. Right?
Yeah, here I have right-handed neutrinos, I don't think I have time to go to the Majorana case. But
roughly, the decay constant for these Goldstone bosons is going to be the neutrino mass.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you would have like this eta prime, which is massive, will very rapidly decay into the lightest ones. Yeah.
14 is 9 plus 9, 18 minus 3 minus 1, which is 8. Where does this 14 come from?
Yeah. So the 14 is exactly this. Yeah. Yeah.
9
so,
plus 9 minus 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. So this is. This is something so one can, from the theoretical argument with the three forms and with generating a mass gap for this three form C, you know that the eta prime is there and all the other ones, because you know you have a spontaneous symmetry breaking effect. If you just write down a generic potential, you could have a further breaking, but there is no way of theoretically requiring this, for example, from anomaly matching conditions or stuff like that. So you can show that this symmetry has to be broken to at least the anomaly-free subgroup of this original flavor symmetry. This would give you just one Goldstone. But I mean, also in the QCD case, you have a further breaking of that. So this is something determined by the effective potential. And in QCD, we have the experimental input that we know how many mesons we have, etc. But in this case, the only experimental input is that we know that we have different masses.
But generically, when I produce those mesons, at least one that I should observe. At low energies.
Yes. Yeah,
so, something like a pion corresponding.
Yeah. So those are like.
That's the phenomenology that we discussed.
Yeah. So but I don't, I don't really know if I have to, because I don't want to like keep you here forever. So,
so there will be a meson exchange between the two electrons, right? So there is a force.
But extremely strongly suppressed, yeah.
Well, you can quantify, right? You've seen that you can quantify how much suppressed, because we know that the, that we can't allow certain forces, right? We will have corrections in helium and so on.
So, I mean, if we consider
force is relatively long range, right?
So it's pseudoscalar, so it's spin dependent. That's definitely so. It's like one over
that's
r
fine.
Cubed or something.
That's fine.
Yeah,
there is a exchange force that is 100% in atomic system. So spin is not an issue.
And if it's controlled by neutrino mass, it's relatively long range.
Yes, it's a long range.
So we look, for example, at something like flavor changing currents, something like in the K and DK. But it's just an example.
Energy physics. Let's take helium atom.
Yeah. No, but I mean the
binding is controlled very well theoretically and experimentally, right? And this is an interaction that has two electrons. Do they interact between themselves due to these new mesons?
Okay, we've looked in many different directions, like cosmology, astrophysics, et cetera, right? Maybe that we have. So this is something we're currently trying to do. If you have this low scale compositeness, whether this can hide it, these new bosons in these theories. So what kind of interactions do you look at? T channel or S channel or U channel or?
You calculate and you measure the binding energies or the level structure in atoms. You can do it. We know if we hyperfine, you can do it all like for 14 digits and so on. For helium binding energy, you can also do it with extreme precision. Now, would understand that there would be a suppression probably by the mass of the electron of the CV scale over the mass of the electron.
Yeah.
Maybe it enters squared, but this is. It sounds like you're not winning by going to high energy, right? So why would I do a flavor changing constraints from mesons? I should do the precision QED at low energy.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, for example, at constraints from astrophysics, you see that this just to show you what like how strong it must be suppressed from other cases that we examined so far. So it is the scale over the energy. So this has to be at least the power of 2 in the in the QCD case. It's the power of 9. So you have a very very strong suppression, and in the so from cosmology, you have a similar suppression that you would expect here. So the
by what? This is a energy divided by m nu?
What?
When you say it's suppressed, what's the small thing that's suppressing it?
Yeah, so I mean the force carrier itself. Yeah, you have those goldstones. You have that's the scale itself where the force becomes important, and then you have some kind of coupling which is supposed to be given by the condensates of those particles. Let's say, okay, you can have electrons, or you can have, in this more exotic phenomenon, you could have something something like this. Then you can estimate the condensates, as in this case, they are given by the symmetry breaking scale. You divide it by the masses of the particles. So, okay, you wanted to have something like electrons. So we can consider this scenario, which is then given by the masses of the electrons. And then I have to check which kind of boundaries you have there. So this is going to be squared.
The point is that it seems like you're having like 1 over ME squared, right? Or 1 over ME suppressions there for the interaction of two electrons, right? That's not this huge suppression. There are lots of relativistic effects, which is also 1 over ME and so on. So
the answer is you haven't looked at those, right?
Precision.
Should be looked at, right?
But so far, from the precision, I mean, like electron mass precision, just coming from alpha measurements, this is as far as I knew, the strongest precision that we have for constraining the scale. But I will look into this, yeah. I mean, there are so many aspects where you have to look into it, like astrophysics and cosmology and all these things. Yeah, and we've been looking into many different directions. And yes, it may be that...
Well, there's another issue also of a sigma meson, right? So each time you have pions and so on, you also have sigma meson, right? Sigma meson here,
yeah,
is straight, will give a coherent force between the neutral atoms, right? Because it couples to electrons and so on.
Yeah, but again, I mean, these forces will be suppressed by the scale divided by the.
By the normal forces suppressed by 1 over M Planck. So if you check the interaction between the two neutral atoms, you have to be. I guess this will be already in the domain of van der Waals forces, but there are super precise measurements of those down to roughly the inverse EV distances, right? So down to microns, we know that the force is not different from gravitational. But if you have new mesons that are one EV kind of mass, that's where you would expect the new Yukawa force, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, so we looked at gravity computing, like these short distance forces, and if you make an estimate of how much you have a suppression factor and you parameterize it, then
you will not receive any interruption, I promise. Just a minute. Just to let her
I think you should let her.
That's true. Yeah.
And then go.
Yeah.
Minutes at least. Go.
Okay. I mean.
Keep on. You want to make.
That way we can release the crowd and we can stay. If we want.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So all right. So this is the okay. Then I skip through it quite fast. So as I said before, if you just write down an effective potential, if you consider all kinds of different. Order parameter contributions to it, you're here in the flavor basis. If you just write down, in principle, it like a general potential would include like an infinite number of those, of course, suppressed by the scale. And then it's a dynamical process, finding the condensate structure. And the only thing is that we showed is here that you can actually, if you write this in a mass basis, you can, if you include up to quartic order invariance in the order parameter, you can have different like x1, unequal x2, unequal x3. So it is, if you just write down the generic potential, you can actually get mass differences. So there is a priori no reason to forbid it, but we can't predict any mass difference. Okay, and I think I will skip the Marana case because this will take too long. So the only thing I wanted to say here about the scale is that so precision measurements from, like, for example, the electroweak Higgs effect constrain this to be much smaller than the QCD scale, because we would, if we have under condensates, that would contribute into those. So for example, quark condensates and so on. Then you have constraints from cosmology. You have an upper bound which is very low, which is similar to the bound we get for the electron mass, because we know that in early universe cosmology, if we have some new degree of freedom that is coupling, for example, to the neutrino sector, then neutrinos are not free streaming anymore. And this is very strongly constrained from CMB observations. And so you see that if you go like below, look at the constraints from below. Of course, if you want to generate neutrino masses, your scale has to be at least some kind of 4 millielectron volts. If you consider a maximal coupling of 4 pi to the condensate, just because you know that the heaviest neutrino has a minimum mass of like 50 millielectron volts. And then that's something we discussed before as well, is that you have just from gravity precision measurements, you have actually proved gravity to like inverse micromillimeter distances, which is corresponding to the millielectron volt scale. And so we just see there's this very small window. And so we've looked into many, many different directions, whether even in this window, it might be completely ruled out, for example, by neutrino decays and by other things. It may be that the window will just shrink to zero and then the effects can't be there. I will look into those contributions. So far, everything what came up in the end was not affecting these conclusions. So we've had many problems. For example, kaon decays would be affected by these new phi particles. But so in our case, this is not the case because they're composite phi particles. So they can't be emitted at high energies. And the same is true for astrophysical processes, where axion-like particles are usually strongly constrained. But if they're composite particles with a very low compositeness scale, then they can't be efficiently emitted. So we just saw, okay, this is somehow coming out of this, that we have this new scale at the scale of dark energy, but we have no say, like, we can't say anything about it, just that there's a numerical coincidence here, because we know there are a lot of vacuum contributions from the standard model into that should be there as a cosmological constant, but they're not there. So this can't solve anything, but there's just a numerical coincidence. And yeah, so one thing I found very interesting is that in this case, if neutrinos gain their masses through this condensate, then they would be massless in the early universe until this phase transition that happens in the late universe. And after the transition, the neutrinos will decay because we have these new phi particles, which will give you transitions between the different eigenstates. So you will end up in the lightest eigenstate, and you can also annihilate the neutrinos after the phase transition into these phi bosons. So you wouldn't, you won't have any relic neutrinos in the late universe anymore. And this would rule out those very strong cosmological mass constraints that we have. And from terrestrial experiments, we have very weak constraints. And there are some experiments, terrestrial ones, that are modeled independently, so independently of cosmology, measuring these masses down to 0.2 electron volts. And this is something one can only see, so Katrin can only measure those masses if these cosmological bounds are invalid. And so this is something, if really all these other phenomenological constraints are like leaving this very small gap where the neutrino masses could still be, then it's possible that they could be detected there, and it can't be explained by a standard cosmology to have such a detection right now. Okay, so we've checked the influence on other cosmological parameters, but I think I can skip this. We've considered like the differences between first or second order phase transitions. In this first order transition, we would get bubble formation. We checked out what kind of topological defects you have. We would have some relic neutrino clustering on Earth due to these self-interactions if some of the neutrinos are surviving. So if we have, for example, more neutrinos than antineutrinos, then not all of them can annihilate away. So we considered many different cases. So you would, of course, have neutrino decays. There you have some phenomenological constraints on the couplings to the phi bosons, where you have a dependence on the Majorana or Dirac nature in those decays. And this is something that I'm doing, like with Georg Raffelt, for example, and Edoardo Pisayano, to check whether this is different for Majorana and Dirac, which it is, and whether this can be resolved because IceCube in the future can distinguish between neutrinos and antineutrinos. And if there are different decay modes for both of them, then it might be possible to distinguish it there. But we are currently working on all the different bounds that we get from astrophysics on the coupling to the phi particles. Okay, and then I have to hurry up here. So we were discussing this gravity competing forces in our other paper, so I didn't go into that here now. One thing that might be interesting is that we have astrophysical environments which are high temperature, high energy environments. We have a suppression of an emission, which is not the case in experiments where we have a low energy transfer. So we don't have this typical, that's what I was mentioning here in the lowest point here with the shine led through walls. There are some experiments that don't have a huge momentum transfer involved. So there we don't have such a strong suppression of the coupling to these axiom-like particles. And yeah, so this is very different from the standard phenomenology, where these axiom-like particles are elementary particles and not composite. And yeah, so we think that this low-scale compositeness is something that hasn't been really discussed so far, that you could potentially hide neophysics effect with a low-scale compositeness and have a softening in high-energy processes with respect, so compared to this usual approach of having just a high-energy scale and suppressing beyond standard model physics effect by suppressing everything what we should observe by this new high-energy scale. Okay, so I think I should finish now. So we had this assumption that we have this topological vacuum susceptibility in pure gravity, so we have this theta term. And one thing one can show with this, just considering the topological sector of this theta term, so expressing this theta term in terms of a three-form field strength and writing down its coupling to fermions in the presence of a gravitational anomaly, one can see that this yields to a fermionic condensation. And if the scale is very low, this mostly affects neutrinos. And then, yeah, so we discussed that one might get masses for all neutrinos from it. We have it independent of Higgs or Seesaw mechanisms, and it works for both Dirac and Majorana neutrinos. And then we discussed some phenomenology, and we're still working out all the constraints that we have. And it might be that in the end, we will find some constraints that rule out this possibility. Yes, but so far we haven't found anything. Perhaps this is something that might rule it out. I'm not sure. So with the suppression of the interaction that we know has to be there, it might be that it's still in there, but I have to look into that. Yeah, okay, so thanks for listening, and if you have any questions, you can ask them.
Since you employed the various phenomenological arguments, I give you this one. I'll take two atoms at the distance of a micrometer, which is like one over electron volt, right? So the gravitational force between atoms has been checked. The coupling of a graviton to hydrogen atoms, for simplicity. The coupling of a graviton to a hydrogen atom is m proton divided by another mp, which is m Planck. So it's 10 minus 19 in one vertex, 10 minus 19 in another vertex, and 1 over ev squared for the propagator of the graviton. It's uncontroversial, okay? So now, if you have your phenomenology and your new mesons, one of them is sigma, is a scalar meson, so it has to be decoupling of that meson to an electron inside a hydrogen atom should be less than 10 minus 19. Then nothing in your expression smells like 10 minus 19, right? Because that would have to be like the coupling of mesons to electrons will be suppressed by some power of that your scale nu lambda over m e, but that's nowhere near 10 minus 19.
Okay, so if we look at the scale, let's say milli electron volt.
Okay.
Let's say it's milli electron volt. Then we look
over an MeV. That's the mass of the electron.
Over like large MeV. Yeah.
Large MeV.
Yeah. Right. So you have 10^6. So then you have a suppression to some power, and you see already like with n equal 1, this is 10^-9.
This is what with this, I'd like to understand.
Yeah.
Right? Because of QCD, I can calculate how the pion, for example, would couple to the sigma meson can couple to say top quark, right? And I'd like to see that calculation, right? But how is it decoupling? Like the should know, right? How does the coupling of the sigma meson, let's say the top quark is stable and it's at short distances, I can still calculate how the sigma meson couples to the top quark and what, how is it decouples? I agree that the top core gets heavier, this decoupling gets smaller and smaller. But what is this n? We can calculate it in QCD. We should be able to do it here, right? Because you're doing direct analogy. Right?
But I mean, in the QCD case, we know the non-perturbative effect. So we know like your, what I just didn't discuss it here. So if we, like one related question is like, how fast does an axion mass turn on in the universe? We know that this is suppressed by the ninth power. So in that case, we have n equal 9 there.
We are not going to be listing various cases where with different powers. I mean, it's a very specific question of how mesons from your new theory decouple from heavy particles.
Yeah.
And this has to be answerable, right? Otherwise, it's why do all that when you can compare to the gravitational.
But should it depend on the non-perturbative, like on the origin of the correlator and how it's softened?
Well, you
and I don't know the computation QCD with the pions.
New non-perturbative happens at the EV scale or maybe milli EV, but you can still integrate out things that you understand, and that these are the scales of the mass of the electron, right? So if you integrate it out, you get something in terms of the maybe again fermion bar, right? And that will have sort of not a very controversial kind of representation in terms of the exchange of the scalar mesons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you should be able to actually figure out what the appropriate power there is, right? And it very well may be that it's a first power, in which case I think the story is finished just from the measurements of gravitational forces at the millimeter.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So I mean, the power has to be at least 2, also from.
You want it to be 2, so that this could
like,
survive.
Yeah.
Right? But maybe I want it to be 1. So.
But one way to address that would be so. In retrospect, the gravitational part of this.
Perhaps we should say that like everyone who wants to leave can
leave
or something.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
But the gravitational part of your story was really kind of more aspirational than anything else. Could I have taken most of your talk and just said, supposing there's a new theory of QCD? Which neutrinos all can now carry a new color, and I'm going to couple a new QCD sector to those things, and then it really will be QCD. And then I could probably calculate all these things, and I wouldn't have to talk about
it. You could consider like some kind of low energy, strong interactions just for the neutrino sector, and then work out the
kernel.
Yeah, suppose
we did that. Then all these answers are very concrete now, because we don't have to talk about quantum gravity,
right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what would N be in that case?
How is it going in the QCD sector where we have?
I'm trying to recall. If I take a top quark and I want to calculate how it couples to something like a pion or a sigma meson, right?
Just write down the sigma meson.
The top quark is point like really, and this meson is large, right? How the decoupling will happen? It's a good question. It's answerable. I unfortunately don't remember. Maybe it's a high power, right?
Yeah.
But it's.
We'll look into that.
It has an answer.
Because I mean, n equal 2 is not high. So, I know the cosmological power. Just the cosmological power for the axion mass, for example, and there it's 9, which is super high, in the QCD sector, just from the non-perturbative QCD interactions that we know. So I haven't checked the power for the pion decoupling in high energy processes.
How do you see the sigma coupling to the top quark in experiment phenomenology? What are you thinking of?
Oh, I'm giving an analog. No, of course you don't, right? But here the analog is the electrons inside a hydrogen atom, right? They will have the coupling
to
their sigma, not necessarily Goldstone's rule. And that gives an attractive force. I actually agree with that. But that attractive force, like, it has to be smaller than gravity at AV, right? So, So you have to suppress the coupling of these new mesons to electrons as one part to 10 to the 19,
but,
right?
But that's the analogous thing in QCD. Is not, there's nothing measurable about it, is there? Is there?
The QCD,
you do it theoretically from an effective theory, I guess, but...
It's not empirical.
No, it's not
but,
empirical.
But you can still... I mean, you can. I want to say you can calculate the coupling through, I don't know, some hard gluons, right? To a soft meson, right? It will be a suppression by the mass of a heavy particle. But I would kind of guess that the suppression would be 1 over m of the heavy particle, and that's it. In which case it's not enough.
Mm.
Good.
Yes. Okay.
Totally proved me wrong about 11 slides being a short talk.
Yeah, that's the reason why.
All depends on what you say, but it wasn't your fault.
Yeah, that's the reason why I just had 11. So-